2 Samuel chapters 23 and 24. The 13th talk in a series on 2 Samuel was presented by David Crabtree on June 20, 2010 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2010. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We're going to be looking at the last two chapters of 2 Samuel. We'll finish it up today. As I argued last week, the last four chapters of 2 Samuel are a unit. They seem to be organized in an A, B, C, C, B, A pattern. That is, there's a chunk of narrative that starts the section in which there is a catastrophe that hits Israel, and David appeals to God on behalf of Israel in the face of that catastrophe, and how that plays out is then described. The second chunk describes those fighters of Israel that killed Philistine giants. The third section is a psalm written by David on the occasion of him being saved by God and preserved by God while he was fleeing his enemies. Then the pattern reverses itself. We have another psalm by David, which is his last song. We'll read that in just a second. That's followed by a list of the mighty men that fought with David. And then the last one is another catastrophe sent by God, and in which David has to appeal to God for help, and God preserves Israel. So you can see the ABC, CBA pattern that this section follows. So I think it is indeed a unit. And it breaks the pattern from the rest of 1 and 2 Samuel. So it seems to be intended to serve a different function here at the end of 2 Samuel. And I think the function that it is serving is to summarize the whole books of 1 and 2 Samuel. That is trying to impress upon us the themes that the author has been outlining throughout the entire narrative. But trying to put together exactly why this is here and exactly what the author is saying is very difficult, and commentaries are very little help on those kinds of issues. So I would like for us all to think of this as a work session. I'm going to go through the last two chapters, but I would like you to put your thinking caps on. And then I'm going to encourage you at the end to make your comments and observations. I would genuinely appreciate that. Starting with the first seven verses of chapter 23. Now these are the last words of David. David, the son of Jesse, declares, and the man who was raised on high declares, the anointed of the God of Jacob and the sweet psalmist of Israel. The Spirit of the Lord spoke by me, and his word was on my tongue. The God of Israel said, the Rock of Israel spoke to me. He who rules over men righteously, who rules in the fear of God, is as the light of the morning when the sun rises, a morning without clouds, when the tender grass springs out of the earth through the sunshine after rain. Truly is not my house so with God? For he has made an everlasting covenant with me, ordered in all things and secured for all my salvation and all my desire. Will he not indeed make it grow? But the worthless, every one of them, will be thrust away like thorns, because they cannot be taken in hand. But the man who touches them must be armed with iron and the shaft of a spear, and they will be completely burned with fire in their place. So apparently this is the last psalm that David wrote. I don't think it's the last words that he spoke, There seemed he's going to have a speaking part continuing into 1 Kings. So I don't think it's the last words that he spoke, but it was the last song that he wrote. And it apparently is kind of looking back over his life and what he has learned. He starts out identifying himself as the psalmist, the son of Jesse, the man who was raised on high, that is, the man who was made king over Israel, and anointed of the God of Jacob. So he's anointed, he is a Messiah. The sweet psalmist of Israel, and his other designation then is the author of Psalms, of which he wrote quite a number, and some of them we have preserved in the book of Psalms. So he's the one who is speaking here. He's the author of this song, and he indicates in verses 2 and 3 that this is coming through the inspiration of God, and this starting in verse 3, then he introduces a metaphor that conveys the central message of what was communicated to him by the Spirit of God. And that is summarized in the last half of verse 3: "He who rules over men righteously, who rules in the fear of God, is like," and here's the metaphor that comes up. And the metaphor is the light of the morning when the sun is first shining on fresh grass that still has the dew on it. So there's a freshness, a newness, a hopefulness that's all built into that metaphor. And that is what a righteous ruler is like. Then in verse 5 he says, "Truly is not my house so with God." So David has established a dynasty that is characterized like that metaphor. But that freshness, that newness, that hopefulness is all a part of David's rule and the rule of his successors. And then he indicates why that's the case. And he gives essentially three reasons. One is because God has made an everlasting covenant with him. And remember back, God did indeed make a covenant with David and his descendants, that he would be, that David would establish a kingdom that would reign forever. And that God has ordered that, and I think what he means, ordered that promise in all things, that everything is working to support that promise and to make it secure. And furthermore, God has operated to bring about David's salvation, that is to rescue David, to protect him, and for all my salvation and all my desire, indicating that David's desires will also be fulfilled. So all of those things God has done as an indication that God has established David's house as that righteous kind of rule. Then he switches and he talks about the fate of the worthless, and I think that means within their midst, that in a righteously ruled kingdom, then there has to be control over, punishment for those who have been wicked. So he uses another metaphor to describe the wicked. They are like thorns that nobody wants. You thrust them away. They are good for nothing, but you can't touch them. And so in order to deal with them, it requires a man armed with iron and the shaft of a spear. So it takes an armed man to deal with them. It takes implements of warfare to deal with them. But they will be dealt with and they will be burned with fire in their place. Okay, so that's the psalm that he declares. And we'll come back to the significance of that later on. The next section, starting with verse 8. These are the names of the mighty men of David, whom David had. Josheb-Bashebeth, the Tachemonite, chief of the captains. He was called Adino, the Esnite, because of 800 slain by him at one time. And after him was Eleazar, the son of Dodo, the Ahite, one of the three mighty men with David when they defied the Philistines, who were gathered there to battle. And the men of Israel had withdrawn. He arose and struck the Philistines with his hand until his hand was weary, and he clung to the sword. And the Lord brought about a great victory that day, and the people returned after him only to strip the slain. Now after him was Shammah, the son of Agi, the Haarite, and the Philistines were gathered into a troop where there was a plot of ground full of lentils. And the people fled from the Philistines, but he took his stand in the midst of the plot, defended it, and struck the Philistines. And the Lord brought about a great victory. Then 3 of the 30 chief men went down and came to David in the harvest time to the cave of Adullam, while the troop of the Philistines was camping in the valley of Rephaim. And David was then in the stronghold, when the garrison of the Philistines was then in Bethlehem. And David had a craving and said, "Oh, that someone would give me water to drink from the well of Bethlehem, which is by the gate." So the 3 mighty men broke through the camp of the Philistines and drew water from the well of Bethlehem, which was by the gate, and took it and brought it to David. Nevertheless, he would not drink it, but poured it out to the Lord. And he said, "Be it far from me, O Lord, that I should do this. Shall I drink the blood of the men who went in jeopardy of their lives?" Therefore he would not drink it. These things the 3 mighty men did. So this section begins his description, the author's description of the mighty men that fought alongside David. Now remember, these mighty men are men that joined David when he fled from Saul, and he went first to the Philistines, and then later he goes into the wilderness of Judea. And these are men that were beside him and helping him throughout that period when he was fleeing from Saul, and then remained loyal to him and faithful to him in his administration once he became king. So they've been with him for a very long time by the end of his life. And so this is just written, I think, in honor of those men, and it is written in a hierarchical manner. It starts out with the 3. He's going to describe the 3, and then it's going to describe the 30. The 3 is the more honored. There are 3 individuals who are singled out for particular honor for that which they have done on behalf of David and on behalf of Israel. And it takes a little snippet, something that's memorable about each one that it includes in the text. The first one is Josheb-Bashebeth. And he's called the chief of the captain, so he seems to be number 1 of the 3. And the incident that it singles out to describe with respect to him is a time when they were fighting against the Philistines. And in that one battle, he killed 800 men. And apparently he fought so hard with his sword that his hand was stuck on the sword, whether it's cramps or whether it's just, I don't know, we used to do this game where you would squeeze somebody's hand for a long period of time, and then the other person would stroke your hand, and then you're supposed to open it slowly. I don't know if you've ever done that, and it kind of sticks. It's hard to open it slowly. That's probably what he was doing. But he's swinging with the sword and kills 800 men, and by the end, his hand is stuck on the sword. So that's the memorable thing with respect to him. The next one was Shammah, the son of Agi the Harite. And the memorable incident with respect to him was a time when apparently the Israelite soldiers had withdrawn and the Philistines are still coming. And he decides he's going to take his stand at this lentil field. Lentils are valuable things. We need to protect them. So he's standing in front of the lentil field as the Philistines come, and he is able to score a great victory. It doesn't say how many he killed. It's just a great victory that he scores at that time. I skipped one, didn't I? Yes, I skipped one. The second one was Eleazar. And he was the one who the Philistines withdrew, and then the Israelites withdrew, and he fought the Israelites single-handedly. And his is the one that's clung to the sword. Okay, so I got two of them mixed together. The first one killed 800, the second one got his hand stuck to the sword, and the third one defended the lentils. Then, in verses 13 through 17, there is an incident that involves apparently all three of the great three. This is at a time when David was in the stronghold in the wilderness of Judea. So he was way down south. And at that time, the Philistines apparently had occupied Bethlehem. Bethlehem was the hometown of David. That's where David grew up. So presumably, it was sometime after David had become an adult that the Philistines move into Bethlehem and occupy that area. And David is not too far away at a stronghold in the Judean wilderness. And I'm not sure exactly what the scenario is. I suspect that David is just thinking about how unfortunate it is that the Philistines have control of his hometown and wishing that they could reclaim that city, and thinking back to his experience at Bethlehem, and in so doing makes the comment, that someone would give me water to drink from the well of Bethlehem, which is by the gate. Something that is impossible because the Philistines control that city. And I don't think that David was actually asking for anyone to do this, at least by his response later on, that doesn't seem to be the case. I think he's just wishing things were different. Wishing that the Philistines were not occupying Bethlehem. But the three take that as a challenge. They're thinking, you know, we can do that. And so the three make their way through Philistine lines into Bethlehem. They draw some water from that well, and they sneak back out, and they present that to David, having accepted his challenge and having risen to the challenge and accomplished the very thing that David was wishing were the case. And David's response to that is, you guys should not have done that. I really wish you hadn't done that. And he pours the water out because he had not intended that the three risk their lives to fulfill that musing challenge of David. But obviously that was a memorable event, and that is included here as something that was accomplished by the three. Okay, then 18 through 39, and there are a whole bunch of names, and I will stumble my way through. And Abishai, the brother of Joab, the son of Zeruiah, was chief of the 30. And he swung his spear against 300 and killed them, and had a name as well as the 3. He was most honored of the 30. Therefore, he became their commander. However, he did not attain to the 3. Then Benaniah, the son of Jehoiada, the son of a valiant man of Kabzeel, who had done mighty deeds, killed the 2 sons of Ariel of Moab. He also went down and killed a lion in the middle of a pit on a snowy day. And he killed an Egyptian, an impressive man. Now the Egyptian had a spear in his hand, but he went down to kill to him with his club and snatched the spear from the Egyptian's hand and killed him with his own spear. These things Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, did, and had a name as well as the 3 mighty men, but was honored. He was honored among the 30, but he did not attain to the 3. And David appointed him over his guard. Asahel, the brother of Joab, was among the 30. Elhanan, the son of Dodo of Bethlehem, Shammah the Haradite, Elikah the Haradite, Helez the Paltite, Ira the son of Ikesh the Tekoite, Abiezer the Anathothite, Membunai the Hushathite, Zalman the Ahahite, Maharai the Netophathite, Heleb the son of Baanah the Netophathite, Ittai the son of Ribai of Gibeah of the sons of Benjamin, Benaiah the Pirathonite, Hidai of the brooks of Gaash, Abial Alban the Arbathite, Azmaveth and the Barhumite, Eliaba the Shaalbanite, the sons of Joshin, Jonathan, Shama the Harathite, Ahiam the son of Sharar the Ararite, Eliphelet the son of Ashbai, the son of the Maakathite, Eliam the son of Ahithophel the Gilonite, Hezro the Carmelite, Paarai the Arbite, Egal the son of Nathan of Joba, Bani the Gadite, Zelek the Ammonite, Naharai the Berethite, armor bearers of Joab the son of Zeruiah, Ira the Ithrite, Gareb the Ithrite, Uriah the Hittite, 37 in all. Obviously, the 30 is misnamed, because it tells us that there are 37. So the 30 must be kind of the title, the name that got associated with them. It was not a precise number. So we have 37 that are listed here. It begins with Abishai, who's the brother of Joab. If you'll recall, Joab was the general for David through most of this text. Joab was David's right-hand man. His brother was Abishai. And Abishai, it says, was the most honored of the 30, but he didn't attain to the 3. So he's just under the 3. And the incident that it says with respect to him is that with his spear he killed 300. And that's how he made his name. The second one that's singled out from the 30, who doesn't attain to the rank of the 3, but who is more honored than the others of the 30, was Benaiah. And it lists 3 things that Benaiah did. One was that he killed the 2 sons of Ariel of Moab, and presumably those are people that would have been known to the readership, and presumably were men of note. The second thing that he did is he went down into a pit on a snowy day and killed a lion. I don't think of lions being killed on snowy days, but apparently that happened. And the third thing that he did was to kill an Egyptian who was an impressive man, so he's apparently a big and strong fighter. And the Egyptian had a spear with him. Benaiah had only a club. And Benaiah goes up against him and is able to take away the spear and then kill the Egyptian with his own spear. And Benaiah was appointed the captain of David's guard, so an elite group that traveled with David and protected David. Then it simply lists the rest of the 30. We have seen a few of these names elsewhere in the narrative, most notably Asahel, who is a brother of Joab and Abishai. And if you will recall, he was killed by the commander of Saul, who Aner was the commander of Saul when there was a civil war following the death of Saul between Saul's son Ishbosheth and David. Abner was the commander of Ishbosheth, and in a battle he killed Asahel, and later then Joab killed Abner because he had killed his brother. The other name that's of particular significance in this list is the last one, Uriah the Hittite, because Uriah was the one who was married to Bathsheba when David had his affair with Bathsheba, and so David arranged for Uriah to be killed in battle so that David could cover up his deed. So we know that two of these 37 died before David did. Okay, then the third section now is going to be another calamity that comes on Israel, and then David has to ask for God's help in dealing with this. The first 9 verses. Now again, the anger of the Lord burned against Israel, and it incited David against them to say, "Go, number Israel and Judah." And the king said to Joab, the commander of the army who was with him, "Go about now through all the tribes of Israel, from Dan to Beersheba, and register the people, that I may know the number of the people." But Joab said to the king, "Now may the Lord your God add to the people 100 times as many as they are, while the eyes of my lord the king still see. But why does my lord the king delight in this thing?" Nevertheless, the king's word prevailed against Joab and against the commanders of the army. So Joab and the commanders of the army went out from the presence of the king to register the people of Israel. And they crossed the Jordan and camped in Aroer, on the right side of the city that is in the middle of the valley of Gad, and toward Jazar. Then they came to Gilead and to the land of Tatim Haji, and they came to Dan Jaan and around to Sidon, and they came to the fortress of Tyre and to all the cities of the Hivites and of the Canaanites, and they went out to the south of Judah to Beersheba. So when they had gone about through the whole land, they came to Jerusalem at the end of 9 months and 20 days. And Joab gave the number of the registration of the people to the king. And there were in Israel 800,000 valiant men who drew the sword, and the men of Judah were 500,000 men. Okay, this is a curious little incident, as are a few of the incidents that we've come across in the narrative. The first thing it says is that the anger of the Lord burned against Israel, and it incited David against them. So God is angry with Israel. And it is because God is angry with Israel that God incites David to do something for which he is going to later punish Israel. There is a parallel account of this event in 1 Chronicles 21. In that account, it says that Satan incited David to do this thing. Now, I won't go into a detailed explanation of how this can be put together, but from the perspective of divine sovereignty, this is not difficult to put together. That ultimately, God is the one who is authoring everything, and therefore it can be legitimately said that God incited David to do this thing that was wrong. From within the story that God is writing, how is it? What is the mechanism by which David was moved to do this thing? Satan acted and incited David to do this thing. So David is incited to do this thing that is wrong. And this thing that is wrong is to take a census. And your question is, how can it be wrong to take a census? We do it every 10 years. In the ancient world, census was taken when a king wanted to prepare to go to war, typically. It's when a king wanted to know what his resources were, in particular what his resources for war were. How many soldiers could he put in the field? And in order to know how many soldiers he could put in the field, he had to know how many men who could fight were in each community. And then he would, presumably what he would do is require that a given community that has X number of able-bodied men provide a percentage of those to fight in his army. So he had to know how many able-bodied men there were and where they were located so that he could then draw his army from and spread the burden of fighting throughout the nation evenly as possible. It is also possible that it's not just for fighting, but it could be for administrative purposes as well. That David wants to know what kind of manpower can he draw upon to do other things, whether it's administration, whether it's bureaucrats that he needs, or whether it's public works infrastructure that he needs built. It's not clear exactly what it is that David intended, but apparently what's wrong is David was wanting to utilize all of the power that he had for his purposes. That apparently there's something that's kind of prideful about what David is doing, presumably. That he is overstepping his bounds. He wants to take all those resources and use them to do something ambitious that is beyond his mandate. So it's something like that that is at the heart of what he's doing that's wrong. Joab objects. Joab immediately says, no, that's not a good thing to do. That would be wicked. And in the Chronicles passage, it's even clearer. And in fact, in the Chronicles passage, Joab says, they're all your servants. And I think that helps support the notion that what David wanted to do was enlist more people in his service, whether it's in the army or in the administration, but he wants to use them for the purposes of state. And Joab's response is, they're already your servants. Let them be. Let them go about doing what they're doing and thereby serve the kingdom rather than enlisting them and making them serve your kingdom the way you want them to serve your kingdom. But David's the king, and David doesn't back down. He doesn't relent. He wants the census taken, and he charges Joab to carry out that census. And so it is, and interestingly, in verse 4, nevertheless, the king's word prevailed against Joab and against the commanders of the army. So Joab was not the only one who was saying, don't do this. The commanders of the army were also saying, don't take the census. Don't prepare for war. Don't gear up. That would be a bad thing. But David says it's going to happen, and it is Joab and the commanders of the army that are sent out to take the census. So they go out, go throughout Israel, and start to count people. So then it tells where the census takers went. It takes them 9 months and, 9 months and 20 days to go throughout the land and to count all the people. And it talks about where they go. And if you were to follow this on a map, it's all the way up into what is now Lebanon. So they're up on the in the suburbs of Tyre and Sidon to the north. They go into Dan, they go into Gilead, and they go all the way down south into the Negev. So by describing where the census takers are going to figure out how many people there are in David's rule, it's charting out for us the territory that David controls. And the territory that David controls is all of Canaan, and then a little bit. And that's going to become important, I think, when we try to summarize things. The number that he comes up with, that Joab comes up with, is 800,000 in Israel and 500,000 in Judah. So 1,300,000. The commentators say that's too large a number, that there couldn't have been, it's just improbable that there could have been that high a population in Canaan at that time. And I don't know, they could very well be right. I will just point out two things. One thing I've mentioned before, and it seems to always come up in the Old Testament. I know from my experience working with chain letters. Remember chain letters? Now in the digital age, things have changed. You can send on a letter by email. All you have to do is forward it. But before that, you had to copy it somehow, either by hand or photocopies. And there was a chain letter that went around, and I got copies of it on a couple of occasions, so I started saving them. Because I was interested in this question of the transmission of texts. What happens in the transmission of texts? What kinds of errors occur? And the thing that became immediately obvious is the two kinds of errors that happen most readily in the transmission of texts is numbers and names. Because language in a sentence, that is to a certain extent self-correcting. If you put in the wrong word in a sentence, say a random word, the next person who comes along is going to spot that for an error. Because you can't just stick any old word in any old slot. But with numbers, you can. And so numbers get messed up. Names do the same thing, by the way. And I found that interesting, and I keep remembering that as I read through the Old Testament. Because there are problems with the numbers in parallel accounts. In fact, the numbers that are here are not the same as the numbers that are in the Chronicles account. And so, just remember, numbers are tricky, and they are easily messed up in transmission. The second thing is, when it says 1,000, it's not clear in the Old Testament always what it means by 1,000. You may think, well, 1,000 is 1,000. It's 999 plus 1. Well, it's not necessarily. It's no more 999 plus 1 than an English pound is 15 ounces plus 1. The things like that change. And the term 1,000 came to be used in ancient Israel as a fighting unit. But a fighting unit apparently historically started out to be 1,000 men. But as time went on, we know that that fighting unit became smaller. So we don't know how many men there were in an eliph when this census was taken. And it could be that this is being described in terms of eliphs, that is, fighting units. So that would lower the total number of men significantly, at least potentially. Okay, so enough on those numbers. Next section, verses 10 through 14. Now David's heart troubled him after he had numbered the people. So David said to the Lord, I have sinned greatly in what I have done. But now, O Lord, please take away the iniquity of thy servant, for I have acted very foolishly. When David arose in the morning, the word of the Lord came to the prophet Gad, David's seer, saying, Go and speak to David. Thus the Lord says, I am offering you three things. Choose for yourself one of them, which I may do to you. So Gad came to David and told him and said to him, Shall 7 years of famine come to you in your land? Or will you flee 3 months before your foes while they pursue you? Or shall there be 3 days pestilence in your land? Now consider and see what answer I shall return to him who sent me. Then David said to Gad, I am in great distress. Let us now fall into the hands of the Lord, for his mercies are great. But do not let me fall into the hand of man. The first thing to note is that before anyone comes to David, David is sorry for what he had done. So the census is taken, and after the census is taken, David's conscience is stricken. And David is sorry that he had done what he had done. He recognizes it as an evil thing that he has done. So he asked God, please take away my iniquity. Then, after David has recognized that, the prophet Gad comes to him. Gad is a prophet who has been with David since the time that he fled from Saul. And he's listed there as one of the ones who left with David. So he has presumably been with David throughout this time. And God had come to Gad and given him a message to pass on to David. And that message is to give David a choice of three things. The choice that he has to make between these three options. And by the way, in First Chronicles, the first option is 3 years of famine rather than 7 years of famine. Here it's got 7 years, then 3 months, and then 3 days. In First Chronicles, it's 3 years, 3 months, 3 days. But the first option is for there to be famine for multiple years. The second option is for David to have to flee before his enemies for 3 months. The third option is for there to be a plague for 3 days. So famine, fleeing, and the plague. Those are his three options. What a horrible choice. I mean, if you think about being in David's shoes and having to choose between those three, he has been given no good options. So David's response is he doesn't actually pick one of the three options. It's kind of a none of the above. But he says, given those options, there's one thing I know. And that is, God is a merciful God. Spare me falling into the hands of my enemies. So basically he's saying, not two. You can do one or three. You pick between one or three, but please, no two. I suspect that this incident happened chronologically after Absalom tried to take the throne, and David had to flee Jerusalem. And I suspect, I don't know how long it's after that, but I suspect that that event was burned into David's mind from then on out for the rest of his life. And David's saying, not that, please. People are merciless. God is merciful. God, give me one or three, but don't give me two. And God is merciful. The response of God was that he was going to he's going to send number three, as we see. Verses 15 through 17. So the Lord sent a pestilence upon Israel from the morning until the appointed time, and 70,000 men of the people from Dan to Beersheba died. When the angel stretched out his hand towards Jerusalem to destroy it, the Lord relented from the calamity and said to the angel who destroyed the people, "It is enough. Now relax your hand." And the angel of the Lord was by the threshing floor of Araunah, the Jebusite. Then David spoke to the Lord when he saw the angel who was striking down the people and said, "Behold, it is I who have sinned, and it is I who have done wrong. But these sheep, what have they done? Please let thy hand be against me and against my father's house." So God does send a plague, and a plague spreads throughout all of Israel. And there are 70,000 people that are killed. So it's a significant number of people that die from this. And they die from in the whole length of the land. There goes the census. The numbers that were given to David are no longer valid. We've got a lot of people now missing in the whole, throughout the kingdom. But once 70,000 have died, God, of his own accord, without being asked, God says, that's enough. And he stops the plague and doesn't kill any more people. He tells the angel of the Lord to stop the killing. And the place where that happens is the threshing floor of Araunah, the Jebusite. And we'll see where that is in just a second. It's just outside of Jerusalem. Now David apparently sees the angel of the Lord. And I don't know whether it's a vision. I don't know exactly what David is seeing, but he recognizes the agent of this death. And he appeals to God, and he says, God, don't kill all these people. They didn't do anything. I was the one who did the wrong. So let the punishment fall on me and my house, my father's house, I'm sorry, against me and my father's house. Don't carry it out any further on the people. They are just the sheep. They are not the ones who did this. Remember back to the beginning of this passage, the reason that this is taking place is because of God's wrath against Israel. And that's why God incited David to do this. But David apparently is not aware of that. As far as David is concerned, all this is happening because of what David had done that was wrong. But God is merciful, just as David had counted on, and the plague is brought to a halt before it reaches Jerusalem. The last section. So Gad came to David that day and said to him, "Go up, erect an altar to the Lord on the threshing floor of Araunah, the Jebusite." And David went up according to the word of Gad, just as the Lord had commanded. And Araunah looked down and saw the king and his servants crossing over toward him. And Araunah went out and bowed his face to the ground before the king. Then Araunah said, "Why has my lord the king come to his servant?" And David said, "To buy the threshing floor from you in order to build an altar to the Lord, that the plague may be held back from the people." And Araunah said to David, "Let my lord the king take and offer up what is good in his sight. Look, the oxen for the burnt offering, the threshing sledges, and the yokes of the oxen for the wood. Everything, O Lord, or O king, Araunah gives to the king." And Araunah said to the king, "May the Lord your God accept you." However, the king said to Araunah, "No, but I will surely buy it from you for a price, for I will not offer burnt offerings to the Lord my God, which cost me nothing." So David bought the threshing floor and the oxen for 50 shekels of silver. And David built there an altar to the Lord and offered burnt offerings and peace offerings. Thus the Lord was moved by entreaty for the land, and the plague was held back from Israel. So Gad comes to David and says, here's what you need to do. You need to erect an altar on the location where the angel of the Lord stopped killing people. You need to erect an altar there, and you need to make offerings on that location. So David goes with an entourage. He goes to the owner of this particular plot of ground where the threshing floor is. And David says, let me buy this. I need this plot of land. I need to buy it. And he needs to buy it so that he can build an altar on this location. And Araunah says, by all means, I mean, you don't even have to buy it. You can have it. And here are the oxen that you can sacrifice, and here's the wood that you can use to build a fire. You can have the whole kit and caboodle. And apparently this is out of his concern for the deaths that have happened. And it's clear in the First Chronicles passage that Araunah, who in that account has a different name, Onan, that he is terrified by this plague that has been taking place around him. David's response is, no way. There's no way that I'm going to take all this stuff, because I am going to make a sacrifice, and I am not going to make a sacrifice that costs me nothing. A sacrifice, by its very nature, has to cost something. So he pays Araunah. Here it says 70 shekels, 50 shekels. It's a different amount in First Chronicles. But he pays for the threshing floor and for the oxen. And then David builds an altar on that location, and he makes the offerings that were called for. And the last verse, then, the verse that concludes 2 Samuel, is, "Thus the Lord was moved by entreaty for the land, and the plague was held back from Israel." In 1 Chronicles, then, it goes on after this event and talks about David, then, gathering together the materials that would be necessary to build the temple. David was not going to build the temple. He had been told by God not to build the temple. But Solomon was going to build the temple. And David said, well, and Solomon's just young. He's not going to be able to pull this off. So I'm going to give him a big head start. And so David gathers together the materials and the people that will be necessary to build this temple. And the temple is going to be built on this location. The threshing floor of Araunah is the location where the temple is to be built. Okay, what's going on in these four chapters? And I've thought about this a lot, and I'll tell you what I've concluded, and then we can discuss it, and maybe you guys can help improve it. But I think something roughly along these lines is what's being communicated by the author with these last four chapters of 2 Samuel. And like I say, I think it's summarizing all of 1 and 2 Samuel. What he's trying to impress upon the reader is that in the time of David, through David as a person, as a king, David has established a righteous kingdom for his people. That God has accomplished what he had set about to do, and what he promised that he would do centuries earlier. We see in the first section where it talks about the famine, that God's anger was turned back through an appeal from David. It was God's anger that was brought about by the action of a king of Israel. This time it was Saul's action. And David appealed to God, and God told him why this was happening, and David took the appropriate action in order to satisfy God and to bring about an end to the famine. So that first section there shows God's anger being turned back by an appeal from David, a righteous king, making that appeal on behalf of Israel. It's kind of in contrast to Saul. That whole thing came about because of Saul. Saul had tried to wipe out the Gibeonites. And the Gibeonites had made a covenant with the children of Israel, a peace treaty with the children of Israel, and Saul was ignoring that. And we can come back, and if we've got time, we can come back and talk about that some more. I think that's interesting. The second section then, where it talks about the Israelites who killed Philistine giants. There were four of them. Here, I think what's being impressed upon us is that David and his men defeated the Philistines, who were the biggest opponents of the Israelites at the time, defeated them despite the fact that there were giants in their midst. They had giants in their midst, and the Israelites were still able to overcome them and establish Israelite control in that part of Canaan where the Philistines had sway prior to that. The third section then, David's psalm. Here the point seems to be that Yahweh is the one true God who came to the rescue of David the king. I'm going to turn back and look at just a few verses there. Here, if you'll recall, David is in great distress. He appeals to God for help. And in verse 8 of chapter 22, God hears his voice. And I'll just read a few verses here, but listen to the language. Then the earth shook and quaked, and the foundations of heaven were trembling and were shaken because he was angry. Smoke went up out of his nostrils, and fire from his mouth devoured. Coals were kindled by it. He bowed the heavens also and came down with thick darkness under his feet. And he rode on a cherub and flew, and he appeared on the wings of the wind, and he made darkness canopies around him, a mass of waters, thick clouds of the sky. From the brightness before him, coals of fire were kindled. The Lord thundered from heaven, and the Most High uttered his voice, and he sent out arrows and scattered them, lightning and routed them. Then the channels of the sea appeared, the foundations of the world were laid bare by the rebuke of the Lord, at the blast of his breath, of the breath of his nostrils. That's enough. The words that are used here are extremely similar to the words you see in poetry written by the Canaanites with respect to their gods. I think that that's really significant because here we have the Israelites being told by God after the Exodus to come into Canaan, and they were to take control of the entire land and establish themselves there. And David is talking about God coming to his aid using words that would have described the Canaanite gods, in particular the Canaanite god Baal. And I think what's being indicated here is God has usurped the place of Baal in this land. God has replaced Baal as the god of this land. But he's not just a Canaanite god, he is the god. But he has, on their own terms, he has destroyed the Canaanite gods. David goes on to talk about God responding to him because he is a righteous king. And then later it talks about even foreign nations come to honor David. And therefore, God is worthy of our thanks because he is loyal to the king and to the king's heirs forever. So those are the main points of that first psalm. The second psalm, then, I think what he's saying is Yahweh has made David's throne a righteous one. And that is a huge blessing to all of Israel. And furthermore, the wicked are going to be or will be destroyed under that reign. Then the fifth section, remember that's the list of the 30. Once again, it's saying God provided David with the people that helped establish him on the throne. He provided him with a group of men that were absolutely critical to David's success. David didn't do this alone. God brought along those people that were necessary to help him do what needed to be done. So all of this was orchestrated by God, I think is the point. And then the last section, then the one we just looked at, once again, God's anger is turned back through an appeal from David. Yes, there's a sense in which David brought about this plague, but remember, more fundamentally, this plague came about because God was angry with Israel. And it was on the basis of David's appeal to God that plague was brought to a halt, and the place where it was brought to a halt is absolutely critical. That's on the very place, just north of Jerusalem, where the temple was then going to be built by Solomon. So I think what that's indicating is the time for the tabernacle is done. It is now time for God to have a permanent place of residence right in the heart of the land that God gave to his people, and under David they came to occupy and control. So I think the whole point of 1 and 2 Samuel is showing God's promises coming to fulfillment in the time of David, that land has come to be possessed by the Israelites in the way that he had prophesied that it would, and that God's hand was behind that taking place all the way through. Okay, little time. Any questions, comments, observations?
I feel like I have to ask this question because I was teaching the Sunday school once, kids, and I was just flipping through trying to figure out what book I was teaching. I can't remember, but it was this section where it seemed like there was a story going on, and one of the three characters lied, and God killed him. And I'm teaching this to kids, and I kind of was trying to figure out how to make sense of that for them because, you know, this is not your typical Sunday school sort of moment. And mm-hmm. I didn't really know how to handle it. Mm-hmm. And in fact, caught a little bit of flack from a parent later on. Yeah. But I was caught by going, yeah, it's there, I read it. And you tell me then how to handle that. And so I'm listening to you explain the end of this and kind of thinking, could you just do me a favor and contrast a loving God with all the death and destruction that he seems to be a part of? Mm-hmm. And I get you did resolve it ultimately there in the end, and maybe that's the answer to the question, but it's not your typical merciful, loving, on and on and on and on.
Yes.
Anyway.
Yes. As C.S. Lewis said, Aslan is not a tame lion. God is not a house pet. He's got his purposes, and his purposes are very complicated, and it's important, I think, to keep that in mind. He's trying to accomplish a lot, and we're all playing a role, but it's not clear to us when we're in the midst of it exactly what that role is. And I don't know, maybe even in eternity we won't know what our role was. In the situation that you're talking about, it's a situation where somebody lied. I think what's more difficult is, and there's one here in Samuel that I find particularly difficult, is when David is taking the ark from where it was housed and he wants to move it to Jerusalem. He puts it on a cart and start taking it to Jerusalem, and it starts to slide off. And one of the guys that's helping David to take it to Jerusalem doesn't want it to fall off, so he reaches out and touches it to keep it from falling off, and God strikes him dead. I find that kind of thing even harder to explain. But there are two levels at which we have to think about God's activity in human affairs. One is at the level of God relating to Israel. And as God is relating to Israel, there are all kinds of things that he wants to accomplish there, and he treats Israel as a unit. Israel will sin, and God will punish that sin. And when he punishes that sin, Israelites will die. There is not always a one-to-one correspondence between the sinfulness of a particular Israelite and who dies. He treats it as a unit, and we'll see that. That happens throughout the Old Testament. He's relating to Israel as a nation, as a person in a sense. It's like a person, and he relates to it as a person. It just happens to be made up of a lot of individuals, but those individuals are all different. They all have a different history. They all have a different role that they're playing. So the other level at which God is relating to people is at that individual level. And we have to assume that as God relates to the individuals, he is doing so in a just and merciful fashion. That is, he's dealing with each person the way they need to be dealt with by him, given the situation. So let's say that in this instance where somebody lied, presumably there's probably two things that are happening. One is God is making a point that he is to be taken seriously. There's a situation in Exodus where they've just come out of Egypt and they've just been given the law, and on a Sunday or on a Sabbath, somebody goes out and picks up sticks to start a fire. And that person is put to death. I don't think that it's because that was such a horrendous evil, but rather it was because God chose to make a point at that particular point in time. His law was not to be messed with. It was to be taken seriously. So that's a point that's being made that's much bigger than that individual. But presumably at the same time, God is relating to those individuals that what happens there is also appropriate for them at that particular time. Maybe not because they're so wicked. Maybe it's some other reason. I mean, people die all the time. God takes people all the time for reasons other than to show up their wickedness. He just chose to take those people in a very dramatic fashion, in a way that's connected with some other truth that he's trying to teach. So I think we have to assume that even this guy who reached out and touches the Ark of the Covenant, that it may seem awfully harsh, but God's making a point there that everybody needs to take note of, and at the same time, he's doing right by that individual. Whatever that entails. And if we knew more about that person's life, we might be able to figure out what God was doing, or we may not. Does that help a little bit?
David, you said there's disparity between names in Samuel and Chronicles and also the amount of money. How do you reconcile those two things?
Well, again, numbers and names, I don't get too worried about numbers and names. Let's take names. Again, names are the most frequently thing corrupted in names and numbers are one of the things that are most frequently corrupted in the transmission of texts. So that's one thing. And the other is people often have multiple names, especially multiple names in a cosmopolitan culture. Peter Cephas. I mean, which name? Which is his name? And I would guess that we have a similar kind of thing here. This guy is a Jebusite, but he's living in Israeli culture, Israelite culture. So it makes sense. It's not shocking to me that he might have two different names. One is a Jebusite name, and one is his Jewish name. And then the numbers on the amount of money, there are any number of things that could account for that. Because in the transmission of texts, a shekel is going to change in value over time. And so if someone were to update a text and put it in 1960s shekels and another one has it in 1990s shekels, they're going to be two different numbers, but the same value. So I don't know. There are any number of explanations, I think, that could account for it.
Sort of piggybacking on to Dusty's question.
Uh-huh.
There's been teaching here about how God is communicating to Israel and that culture in a language that they can understand. Like the temple, for instance, has all the bits that other right. temples have.
Right.
Do you think that it's a sort of cultural value? I mean, just in general, there seems to be a lot of emphasis on, you know, in David's Psalms and elsewhere, it's like, you know, these people will be struck down and slayed and there, you know, there'll be blood up to the stirrups and mm-hmm. so forth. That seems to be a fairly common sort of cultural value in that time. Do you think that's, could you just comment on, is that what, is part of it is God is communicating in sort of a way that culture could understand?
Are you questioning whether it's that value or that language? You see the distinction I'm making?
Not exactly.
Well, is it? Well, I think the answer to the question is that God uses not just a language that exists and exists as a part of a culture. He also uses a culture and a language of cultural symbols to communicate his message. And so it's not surprising to me that there are a lot of Canaanite cultural symbols that are used by the authors of the Bible, because they're drawing upon that treasure house of culturally known things, just like a language. A language has a vocabulary. Well, a culture has a cultural vocabulary. And that the cultural vocabulary that the authors of the Old Testament are drawing upon includes a lot of Canaanite cultural words or symbols. That makes all kinds of sense to me. I think that's what we should expect.
There's, I mean, not so much here, but in other churches, there's this sense that the Old Testament God is very different from the New Testament God. That seems to be, the more you look at it, the less and less that seems to be true. But there is a sort of, you know, there is a lot of bloodiness
yes.
present in
yes.
the Old Testament. And I guess my question is, like, is God using that sort of destruction in mm-hmm. the in the Old Testament because that's what everyone speaks.
Well, I don't think it's just because that's what everyone speaks. I think he's making a point, and the point is something like God means business. There's a seriousness to this. And I think ultimately what we are to understand is there is a judgment coming. And God isn't messing around. There is a judgment that is coming. Just as there is a temporal victory on the part of the Israelites being led against the Canaanites, there will be an eternal victory of God against evil and wickedness. So, and that imagery is not completely absent in the New Testament. I mean, Revelation is a good example of that. So that's not abandoned. It's just that in the New Testament, what we see in Jesus is another aspect of who God is, I think. And that helps round it out. It's not that that aspect of who God is missing in the Old Testament, but it becomes much more prominent as we see Jesus live out his life. But the knee-deep in blood is not completely gone, I would say, in the New Testament. Okay, I need to let you go. Thanks.